Hello and welcome back to HIF Player, the podcast from Harrogate International Festivals. You are joining with audiences from across the globe to enjoy HIF Player, bringing Harrogate International Festivals into your home. We're thrilled to bring you the expert panel discussion, What's Next for the NHS, interviewed live by broadcast journalist Jerry Foley at the 2023 RayWiffs Harrogate Literature Festival. Sit back, relax and enjoy a fascinating and thought-provoking discussion with Dr. Waheed Aryan and Stephanie Snow.
Just before we get into the meat of the panel, I was going to suggest to the organisers that when it came to selling tickets for this event, we should all have been given one number to ring at 8 o'clock in the morning. keep ringing. Your caller number 27, very keen to talk to you, and then you get through and say, no tickets left. Come back tomorrow. Try again. And then when you arrive for this particular event, I thought, we'll get you all in at 12:30, and then about 3 or 4 hours later, we'll come out and say, the panel is ready to see you now. Which is, you know, unfair misrepresentation, but a sense of the frustration. We have so much to talk about. And we're going to start, because it is a book festival, about the two books. This is Stephanie's book, Our Stories, which will go down in history. It's a landmark study of people who've worked and have been patients of the NHS since the beginning, and it's all part of an oral history project which is now at the British Library. So tell us a little bit about how this came about and how you selected the people to go into this book, because there are so many stories which could have been told in book form.
Okay, so my background, I'm a historian, so I look at the history of health and care and medicine. And I started working on the history of the NHS back in about, 2008, something like that. And I became really aware that what's written about the NHS doesn't really sum up that everyday characteristic of it. And when you think about its first creation in 1948, the part of the welfare state, we've had 75 years now of that, and it's been part and parcel of everybody's everyday life. So whether or not you work in it, whether or not you're a patient, whether or not you've got a hospital down the road, or you've got a community centre, none of us have been able to live our lives without the NHS playing some part. So if we want to know what that 75 years was like and what experiences have been like, and if we actually want to think about what the future might look like, then we need to hear the voices, and the voices of the people who created the NHS in the first place, developed it, built it, have experienced it and lived it. So that was the real drive for getting a project off the ground that could capture that. So we now have the most amazing collection of almost 2,500 interviews that are deposited at the British Library, will be a permanent resource accessible to everyone over the world. I mean, choosing people to come in this book, I mean, it was a nightmare, to be perfectly honest, because there were so many wonderful voices. But in the end, what I wanted to do was to pick each decade and select voices that could talk about some of the key things of those decades, to really try and give people who read the book a flavour of how life has changed, how work has changed, and how the NHS has responded to our needs as a society as we've moved through the period.
And we'll pick out some of those key elements in the book, as well as a broader issue about the many challenges facing the NHS. Waheed, your book is, and your life story is, quite extraordinary. When you grew up in war-torn Afghanistan under Soviet occupation, ending up in a Pakistani refugee camp, almost dying from TB at 5. You didn't know anything about the NHS. Because why would you?
I didn't.
And you came to the UK as a refugee, age 15, with little or no language. And you've ended up to have a hugely impressive career in the NHS and your charity work. So just give us your first impressions of when you started to be a doctor training within the NHS system.
Thanks very much again for having me here, and it's a really privilege to be amongst you, speaking just so close. We talk in the media, we talk on broadcast, but it's a special feeling there. So thank you to everyone for making the effort to come in. Actually, my dream to become a doctor was born in that refugee camp, that when we left, like millions of other refugees, from Afghanistan who went to Pakistan to take refuge because of the war ongoing. We're one of those families. We stayed in one of the tents, had one sort of little tent in one corner. As a family of eight, we had no food. The only ration that was given to us is some of the food and other necessities that were given to us by the UN Refugee Agency. Temperatures were rising up to 45 degrees centigrade, and we had only one fan that was powered by one of our neighbors who gave us electricity cable. And within days, most of us got malaria, like most of the other refugees in the camp. And within 3 months was that when I started coughing. I was coughing to the extent that I even brought up blood, and I was getting so weak that I couldn't walk more than 5 meters. And that's when my parents knew that this was not the common cold, and they had to do something about it. So they took me to the local doctor. When I was standing in the queue for the local doctor, it was a massive queue late in the evening. It was really hot and sticky, very uncomfortable, but my dad was holding me. We got in there, there was somebody sitting with a lamp, but white coat, a stethoscope, but he had the smile on him. I was, this man is mad. Why is he smiling? You know, this is so hot, I just want to get out of here. But he was in this room, this claustrophobic room. So it really made me curious, why is he smiling? So he examined me and he told my father that I had to be taken to a specialist. So he took me to a specialist in Khaybar Bazar in Peshawar city. Some of you might be familiar. It's a city of hustle and bustle. They're selling food in one corner, and the next corner there are rugs. And then there is one shop which says the specialist, lung specialist. Another shop is the heart specialist. That's how medicine is practiced outside privately. Mm-hmm. So I was taken to the lung specialist. He examined me. He weighed me, and afterwards he asked my father to take an x-ray. So we went next door. Next door was the x-ray machine. So I hugged the x-ray machine, and when they took the x-ray, they gave it to me, and I was just absolutely fascinated by my body parts, looking at it. Wow, I have an x-ray. Because I was never used to for my photographs being taken, you know, in war zone. We don't get the luxury of being photographed and kept as a collection. So I took that to the specialist. The specialist put it against the white background, had a look at it, and then asked me to sit outside. And that's when he said to my father that your son has advanced tuberculosis and he has 60% chance of dying, actually, if that's how it goes, because he's so malnourished. My father told him that, you know, I don't want to hear the percentages of him dying, just let me know how to save him. So he gave him some medicine and told him that I had to be kept happy, nourished, and all this conversation, I was just listening to it very, very carefully. And on the way back to the camp was, I remember that I was in my father's lap and he was crying. And I didn't dare ask him why, because I knew that there was something really, really serious wrong. But that back and forth interaction that I had with the doctor to go, keep going back and forth, to keep being weighed, examined every 3 to 4 months for medicine to be checked, was what inspired me to become a doctor.
And just on that, when you were looking at that x-ray, of course, then when you went on to train in the NHS, you became a radiologist, so you're looking at x-rays all the time. And also, we'll talk a little bit later on about your telemedicine work back in Afghanistan over a phone, looking at fairly rudimentary x-rays, but being able to guide the doctor on the ground. So I want to come back to, and you were very lucky to survive, and also it has to be said that your family were fortunate enough to have limited means, but some means to actually pay for an x-ray in those days, because most people couldn't have.
Many people did die, absolutely. I agree with you. I think that's a good correlation between what I did in radiology later on and that. But the doctor was somebody who gave me a black and white textbook and a stethoscope.
And age five.
He did. That was because I didn't have any toys, and I always fascinated by his stethoscope, and I was asking him, you know, what is this? What is that? And he thought, you know what, one day, son, I think you're going to become a doctor. So let's give you that.
It's a great story in terms of your determination when you get to the UK with little English to do your A-levels, to get into Cambridge, and then how you studied and worked and studied and worked all the time. We'll come into that. But we've already established that Waheed was lucky to survive. And one of the figures, Stephanie, which struck me when I was reading around about the NHS and everything else, there was a piece in the Times not so long ago which was talking about the decline in the effectiveness of the NHS in terms of what it's doing because of the pressure it's under. And the figure was, when the late Queen came to the throne in the early 50s, life expectancy in the UK was number 7 in the world. Today, it's number 29. That is not a good story. And this is something which you've charted. So when do you think, every decade there were problems, challenges, when do you think the real critical mass has really accelerated?
I think the NHS has had challenges right from the get-go. I mean, when you look at those reports of the 1940s, there were nurse shortages straight away. So people were being recruited from Europe, from Ireland, and then from the 1950s, the African Caribbean opened up. And without that push to recruit people from other places, the NHS wouldn't have survived its first decade. So I think that's one of the first things. And the workforce problems are still there today. But I think what's changed about the workforce issues is that now healthcare is a global market. So if you're a qualified healthcare worker, there are opportunities across the world. What I think, the thing that keeps me positive about the NHS is that so many people are attracted to it because of its founding principle of separating care from the need to pay at the point of care. And, you know, we've interviewed people who've come from different countries, and one of the reasons that they've chosen to stay in the NHS and work in the NHS is because they really believe in that, and that they believe that having that separation as a health professional between asking patients to pay and treating them enables them to give care that is freed from those considerations.
If Julia was here, she'd be nodding her head vigorously on this, because she talks very vehemently against creeping privatisation, the level we have. And it is something which has to be addressed if we already have a two-tier system. Just on the workforce, because you were saying just before we came on, you go to any hospital, and today what is striking is just how many people from different nationalities have ended up in the NHS, and yet we're crucially short of staff. So what's your experience of working with other people from other countries? Why have they come to Britain? Why have they come to the NHS? What is it that attracts them here, despite the pressures and despite ongoing strikes about the level of pay and support?
I think I'll just extend that very good question, a little bit broader. Why do people come here in the first place? And why did I come here, you know, and then went on to become a doctor?
I'm just going to check that everybody can hear, because apart from being incredibly modest about his achievement, he's also quite softly spoken. I just want to make sure, is everybody okay? If you could just raise your voice, like...
Louder, of course.
A bit louder, okay.
If you're prepared for that, then I'll speak even louder.
No, we don't want to miss any words from the panellists. A little bit louder would be good. Thanks.
So the reason actually why people come in to the UK, and it's a very important question, I think we need to address that, and why I came here is that actually people, when they flee conflict zones, this is about the refugees and displaced people.
They've just tried to turn it up a little bit. Keep us informed if you're having problems.
Yeah. And for people, the migrants that Professor Stephanie that just talked about and you also have talked about when they come in with regards to their jobs, so there's a difference between them. Forcibly displaced people, refugees, when they flee conflict zone, they have got no option really, because they're in the midst of this war that very sadly most of us are watching at the moment, and it's really brought so horrible memories for myself. But I can only imagine the terrible situation they're going through now, that millions of people are affected overnight, literally, that the bombs are raining on them. What do they do? We see them on the screens. They run this direction, that direction. On the way, they're killed as well. So it's the civilians who pay the heavy price of war. And for these people, they can't just go online to ask for a visa. They can't wait 1 to 2 years. So this is really to negate all the narrative that, oh, you have to seek the refugee visa and then we will let you in. It does not operate. It does not work. So we really have to be clear on what people in conflict zones are dealing with. So when they flee any way they can, if they can get out of that war zone, they go to a neighboring country. In my case, I went to Pakistan when my life was in danger in 99. My entire family couldn't get out. I was the only one. So when I went there, then I had to find a way. And I went from one place to another. They wouldn't even let me into the embassies, to the doors of the embassies. So that's very sad. But then the only available route was for my parents to sell everything, put it in the hands of this agent who promised this refugee visa, which was not a refugee visa. But that was the only
route available. But it was a forged passport.
It was. And that was a ticket for me to get out and to be alive, to be who I am now. So, but each circumstances of each person, they actually vary. So we can't generalize in that sense. So people, whatever route they're taking in, I'm talking about genuine refugees here, majority, 70, 80% fleeing conflict zones, their lives are in danger. And now, they don't have really a choice. But the people who make a choice is based on language, is based on if they have a friend, if they have a family member. So you can imagine if you leave your home, you're going traveling somewhere, and if there is a friend on the other end and tells you that, come here, I'll show you around, you know, almost always you'll be inclined to go to that place. If you don't know the language, you don't know the culture, you don't know if somebody is going to be actually nice to you or not nice to you. And that's very simple measures of how people make those decisions, which I did as well. I could speak a bit of English. I had a friend who said, you could get education, you could do some work. And that was enough for me to make that decision. So I came here because of those reasons. And I think taking that discussion back now into the NHS. So once people are given the opportunity to actually verify their education or upgrade their education, they're very talented. They've got the skills. And they would love to work in the NHS. And there are people I know, I work with refugees at the moment, that they're doctors, they're nurses, they're lawyers, but they're not allowed to work. They are kept in this web of legalities and really inhumane treatment that you can't even work. And that they get depressed from that. They have no satisfaction. Whereas on the other hand, that we know in the NHS, every shift that I do, we have staff shortages. We rely on agencies.
At
they're
exorbitant
rate. Posted. Everybody is exhausted. So the staff shortages is not something that happens in one hospital. It's throughout the country, and it has negative impact on the people like myself, for Stephanie, who's working, that we struggling. And that translates to patient care. So you can see the whole cycle of how we've got the resources, we've got the talents, but then we're not utilizing them, and we're continuously understaffed.
Stephanie, you mentioned about the global market now for healthcare workers. And for decades, of course, Britain was the magnet, and certainly this was the case in Ireland. Loads of doctors and nurses came over to work in the NHS, and throughout the book, there are people from all nationalities telling their stories. And of course, the accusation was, here was Britain, then a rich country, stealing people who've been trained and leaving behind, you know, services which would have been of benefit to the people living in that country. Now it's the reverse, because we're saying, oh, doctors are flying off to Australia or New Zealand because they get much better pay rates. Well, it's kind of swings and roundabouts, isn't it?
Yes, and in the 1960s, there was a real concern because doctors were being recruited by Australia and Canada and the United States. So I think there's always been a push and pull in terms of where people go and why they go and things. And it's also the fact that life gets in the way. So a lot of people who think, oh, well, I'll go to this place and I'll work there for a bit and then I'll go back home. Actually, they like the work, they fall in love, they marry, they have a family. So it's like, what they might have set out to do isn't necessarily what they end up doing. But I guess one of the things that I would really like us to learn from the history of using people from other places to work in the NHS and bring all the amazing skills. I mean, just think what we'd have lost without you. I mean, you can't put a value on that. But what I would like us to recognise is that people come with talents and skills and that they can actually bring new things. I mean, when we look at the first black communities in Britain who came in the 1950s with Windrush and so on, it was the black nurses who drew attention to the particular needs of black patients because they had particular skin conditions. You know, it was then found that African Caribbean people tend to have particular diseases like sickle cell disease or thalassemia. So it's like if you've got nurses with us from those same communities and heritage, you've got the option of actually developing really excellent services for them.
Okay, talk about excellent services. I gave the figure at the beginning about the decline in Britain's standing when it comes to life expectancy. Waheed, you work at present at weekends in accident and emergency. The president of the Royal College of Accident and Emergency Specialists, Dr. Adrian Blake, I think, he said recently the system is failing patients. He said there's an average wait for people over 80 of 15 hours. You're getting a new mic, by the way, so I'll extend this question slightly.
It was not my fault.
No, it wasn't, no. There's an average wait for people over 50, over 80 rather, 15 hours. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're failing patients every day. You must see this in your work.
This is very sad to see, actually. It's we talked about it early on before coming here, and it's not just in my trust, it's actually throughout the country that we are failing patients. Patients who really need our help. They're going through heart attacks, through strokes, and we look at them in ambulances. We go and try to do something, but we can't provide that timely and that quality service that they desperately need. And there are many factors to it that, of course, it's difficult to summarize what's going on.
What's the key factor? There are many factors, yeah. But what do you think is the key failure that could be rectified within a year, 2 years, or is that just unrealistic to even posit that question?
I think it's just a disconnect between the community and the acute services. At the moment, our community services are not up and running. There are many people who are ready to be discharged, who shouldn't be in hospital, and they are there. And there are people who desperately need help, but they can't get in. So we have got this problem here that we're absolutely jammed. It's a traffic jam. And the acute services, A&E, accident, emergency, acute medical services, and so on, we're absolutely jammed. And there are people we can't shift and who don't need to be there. So you can see where the problem here is. But
why has Britain, over the last 20 years, almost been an outlier across European medical services in terms of reducing the number of beds per head of population, which is what you're saying. There's a shortage of beds. We saw that during COVID. Mm. The NHS operates at close to full capacity, 90-92% of beds occupied. So, Stephanie, can you even explain when that policy, what was the thinking behind that policy when it came in? Was it purely about saving costs, or was it more strategic, saying people are better treated in the community, except as Waheed says, well, the community side isn't working, so they all end up in A&E seeing you?
I mean, I think from the beginning of the NHS, treatments have changed and diseases have changed. So generally, over its life history, you've seen a change from people having to spend a very long time in hospital, which was the case in the NHS, you'd be in for literally months. But then with the antibiotics, new treatments, day case surgery, it's like the turnover is much, much quicker. So I think there's been that constant drive to keep people in hospital for as short a time as possible, because if they get the right treatment in that short time, that's actually the best outcome for everyone concerned.
But as Waheed says, but we're now facing a traffic jam, even with keeping people for a very short period of
time. Exactly, but over the 75 years, we've got a larger, more elderly population, which means that it's the gap within social care, and it's this gap between what the NHS does and where social care picks up That's where the real sort of block is, because you've got people in hospital that cannot safely be taken home. They need like a third area to go to. Sure. Now, some places, I mean, in Manchester, for example, when we had COVID and they developed the Nightingale Hospitals.
As they did in Harrogate.
As they absolutely. So the Nightingale Hospital in Manchester actually became a space for this halfway house. So for patients in transition between acute hospital and going back home, and that worked very well. And I think it's one of those things that if you've got a service and you've got the limited buildings and capacity you've got, it's actually very hard to keep moving things around to adapt to the current demands.
But an extra bed is only an extra bed. It has to have the staff. I mean, you will see this every day, that you can say we'll have 10 more beds for winter, but if you don't have the nurses and the support staff and the doctors to go and see the patients in that bed, well, it's kind of pointless.
No, absolutely. It's about safe discharge from acute to community services. One is when the antibiotics, for example, stops, they may have other needs like physio, occupational therapist, a little bit more mobility and all that. So you do require other resources around the services in the community. And they are not there, unfortunately, to the level that can really accommodate, as Professor Stephanie had mentioned, the aging population, the broad range of diseases we're seeing at the moment. And one other big problem is that we do have pockets where things are working, and you've touched upon that. The big problem, another big problem that we see with the NHS is they're not very good, or we're not very good at scaling and adopting a solution that's working well in one place across the country. We're not very good at communicating with each other, sharing good practices. And that's very sad. It's because
and
we
why
know
is
it's
that
working.
Because you, when you set up your TeleHeal, which is working with doctors in Afghanistan and also in Africa and other parts of the world, it sounds like it's high tech, but you're actually quite open in your book. You didn't even own your own laptop until 2015. You always use university computers and everything else, hospital computers. So there are innovative methods of working, but you say, why is there this blockage in terms of sharing best practice, sharing technological advances across different trusts? What's gone on?
I think we can be talking about what's gone wrong with the NHS for hours, but I have to highlight as well that, you know, it's one of the biggest organizations in the world as well. So, and it is the treatment that provides, I mean, the number of people we look after is absolutely enormous globally. So you could expect something or the disconnect or sort of the disproportionality in care from any big organization. But in particular, when it comes to the NHS, there are various pathways that are not connected. If you look at the technology, in some hospitals, you're still writing on a piece of paper to request an X-ray. Whereas, and we have to write every single note, it takes me probably 10 minutes to see a patient, and I love to talk to them. So even in A&E, I close the door and I pull a chair, because that grandmother, mother would love to see, you know, that I care and I really value
that. You're big on compassion as core to medicine, and the stories here are about care, Stephanie, as well. So you make time even with the amount of pressure, but that's increasingly difficult for your colleagues.
It is, but for me, I mean, that's the reason why I picked up a stethoscope. And for most of us, that's the case. And I think that's a really important point, is that when you bring in the other pressure, the staff pressures, when you bring in the political pressures, management pressures, and the staff are not being valued, they're not provided at least a good meal, or say thank you for the hard work that you do. A lot of the clinicians, the seniors, they do, but even they are not appreciated. Then you can see the cycle that then you forget why you came in the first place. Because I do other stuff, you know, I'm not heavily reliant everything on that. When I go to that shift, I go with a mentality that I would love to see my patients. I would love to give them the 3 or 4 minutes that they need from me to look me in the eyes, and I look them in the eyes to say, I care, and I'm here to treat.
Let us know when you're doing your next shift at Shrewsbury, and make sure that we're all available that weekend. But you were talking about being valued and everything else, and this is something which comes out in your book, Stephanie, in terms of increasing pressures, and that's having an impact on the mental and physical well-being of the staff themselves, which is recognised, but also because of the pressure of the service, sometimes the public, quite rightly, are very frustrated and take it out on staff. So that's something which has changed maybe in the last 10 years or so, would you say?
I think we see it particularly sharply in COVID and then the post-pandemic period, because before we went into the pandemic, the NHS was already suffering significant workforce shortages. So then you had the pandemic on top, and staff did the most amazing job, and they pulled all the stops. When we interviewed people about what their experiences had been like, it was absolutely extraordinary what they had done to do whatever they could to save lives. But the impact of that at a personal level was enormous. So as we've come out of the pandemic, patients have very naturally been very frustrated by the lengthy waiting lists, cancelled appointments, not able to get treatment. And I think the real gap has been there has been no transparent public conversation between what the NHS is actually capable of delivering in this post-pandemic period with the staff it's got, and actually what patient expectations are. And I think this.
How big is that gap?
Well, I think, again, as Waheed said, you know, different places, different experiences. But I think it's much broader. I think it's a much more common thing now than it has been before. And I think staff felt it particularly sharply when, during the pandemic, there was all the clapping and the NHS heroes and things. And actually, NHS staff don't want to be thought of as heroes. They just want to be thought of as doing a good job. But I think to go from that to then being the subject of, you know, abuse and complaints and, you know, justifiable patient frustration, they're caught in that really difficult space when they can't do anything else because they're one nurse and they're looking after the number of patients that actually need four nurses.
Waheed, you talk in your book about your own personal experience of working during the pandemic and just the pressure you felt, but also the pressure you felt about going home to your family, and how intense the cleansing process you had to take when you went in. And you yourself caught COVID and, you know, you had to isolate yourself for 5 or 6 days. I mean, what was that sort of mental torture? Because we could watch it on TV, but you were going into COVID wards every day.
It was a horrible experience, tragic for many families who lost their loved ones. So the impact on the staff was on so many different levels. On one hand, not being able to provide the treatment that to save the patients. We are trained to do something. We're trained, you know, to be able to do a maximum. But then we are throwing the antibiotics and throwing oxygen and everything, and things are not working. You question yourself. It's like, what's going on? Mm. The uncertainty of it has really got to seniors, to juniors, to the nursing staff, of the various protocols, guidelines coming every week. I saw the news coming from various outlets saying one thing, then something else. And then you see people that, young people who coming in and they have to be rushed to intensive care. And then we find out that they didn't survive. Mm-hmm. So all that is really was leading to traumas. So this is something to be really clear about, is that the majority of the population and the staff, NHS staff, healthcare in particular, and anybody else who was working on the front line in the market or anywhere else, they have been exposed to a lot of traumatic experiences. So this is not just stress or a simple episode of something not going right. And then, as Stephanie has mentioned, that after the COVID, when we came out of it, we pretend nothing happened. Mm. So there is a lot of deep-rooted trauma there in people that's not been resolved. And immediately you're thrown back into that, okay, you've got 8 ambulances to deal with now. Forget about what happened with COVID, we're done. And that's not how mental health works. Mm. I know it because of my own mental health issues when I came, that I brought in PTSD.
You've been very open. I've worked in this space, to explain. At October is a difficult month for you because you're quite open. That it was 17 years ago, you had a major breakdown. But also that has coloured the way in which you see the stress and strain that other people are under, not just patients, but also colleagues in the workplace.
Well, absolutely. And I think it's mental health issues, in particular when we talk about trauma, it's not comparable. So it's not fair to compare, for example, my traumas from conflict zone to somebody who suffers in hospital. Mentally, emotionally, they may be experiencing the same level of distress that I did. So that's why I can empathically really connect with the colleagues who've been through these situations. And sadly, the resources are not there. And just to clarify about my own experience very briefly is when I came to the UK, and most refugees, when they leave conflict zones, up to 22, 25%, they suffer from complex mental health and severe mental health issues like PTSD, severe depression, and anxiety. So I was one of them. I was not screened for, and I went to medical school. I was working extremely hard. So the coping mechanism I had was that I was launching myself into all the opportunities that I never had, and I was running, so I was using exercise. So I had a purpose. I was doing things to keep myself busy, and I was using all the energy of fight or flight response in a positive way. But deep down, the traumas didn't go away. And then it was 8 years or 9 years down the line when I was after Cambridge University, I came to Imperial College in London, when I suddenly ran out of that fight or flight adrenaline and I was questioning things. You know, what on earth happened to my childhood? What on earth am I not like everybody else? Who can go on holidays, who can have friends, who can have family members around the table? I have none. So that's what it all led to the breakdown that I had, and sort of shapes my thinking about mental health and the way I think about the mental health of the population and the colleagues.
And people, by and large, are much more open about struggles with mental health. And one of the things which features in the stories, because you go back right to the 1930s and then 40s when the NHS started, is the way in which the approach to mental health has changed. Not enough, because it's some people regard it as a Cinderella service still, but I mean, people in the late 40s into the 50s, 60s were basically locked up and almost forgotten about. Mm-hmm. And you tell the stories of people who worked in those kind of wards. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Ethel Armstrong, who features in the book, she began work as an 18-year-old on the day the NHS was launched in July 1948. She began work at one of the big old mental asylums where she describes walking up this huge drive and then every single door was locked and unlocked behind her. And she said they were just poor people who had just been incarcerated for years. And there was no treatment per se. And there was so much social stigma about it. Nobody would talk about it. And then from the 1980s, things did start to shift with lots of different thinking about mental health. And that actually, if people are part of a community and they've got support from a community, then for a lot of mental health conditions, that's by far the best way. So, I mean, certainly, I mean, we've got stories that tell that change. But I think a lot of the voices still say, you know, that's one of the areas that we need to really improve. And I mean, a very young interviewee who shared with us her experiences of psychosis, which was an absolutely terrifying experience. But she said when she had that acute diagnosis, she immediately got much better treatment than she had when she'd just been diagnosed with depression and anxiety. So again, it's the sort of, you know, it's the way we as a society look at those different labels, isn't it? And how we treat people and how the system treats people.
We promised there's going to be plenty of time for questions. We are obviously going to go on to talk about funding, waiting lists, cancer treatment. You can ask questions on any of those. So let's put the lights up for a moment. And Clem is going to have the microphone, hopefully, if we haven't surprised her by calling it this early. Yeah. Do we have a mic? Okay. Yeah, right in the front row. Came in nice and early. So if you bring it up and they say, we're going to go into the questions about how can we improve and tackle some of the big challenges. Go ahead, just keep your hand up. Just here, just in front of you. There you go. Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to say that I have worked in social services and in the National Health Service for donkey's years, as had many of my family. I'm also very old, and I remember clearly having to write bills out for private patients for my father, who was a GP, before the NHS came in. I am now concerned about what on earth is going on because people who can afford it are now going to private GPs. And that's splitting the service away totally from what it was intended to be. And the other thing I want to say is that I see no hope for the future unless people with the power understand that the future is not just the NHS, it's NHS right to the end of life. And people should be talking to each other between social services and the NHS. And we've had, you know, they've talked in the newspapers all these years since the 60s about the need to get together. Well, we've never got together yet.
Thank you for bringing your experience and your point about social care and what happens. That is still the unanswered big question.
I think the state should pay for all students who want to be doctors.
Right, okay. We're going to go on to funding in a moment. Thank you. Can I just, you've raised a broader issue of privatisation. There is an argument that people are being forced against their better wishes. They're so desperate to get treatment that they are paying for treatment. This is a book for you in terms of the campaign against privatisation. But is there a role for privatisation? I mean, the patient Labour have said they will use private sources to try and clear backlogs. Is the patient really that concerned about if it's free for them? Are they concerned about the fact that it's a taxpayer paying for it in a private clinic because they can't get into an NHS hospital? Stephanie?
I think there are different views. I think there are some patients that would feel very badly that they weren't being treated in an NHS space. I think there have been times when the NHS has used private services and that has worked very well. But there have been also times when it's gone to extremes. For example, back in the sort of 2000s, there was a push to get waiting lists cleared and some people were sent over to Europe for operations like hip replacements and things. But the issue with that was that if they came back home and there was then a problem, they didn't have access to the same team who'd done the operation.
But what if they came back and didn't have a problem?
Exactly.
And so, it worked.
Swings and roundabouts. But I think we go back to this sort of point about, you know, this is what we need public conversations about, that if we've got limited resources and we've got a population with a set of health needs, it's a joint decision. It has to be a democratic decision as to what do we prioritise, how do we resource it. You know, let us think about what happens if we pay absolutely to the end of life and integrate social care. And, you know, as a society, where's the support for that?
But people at your level in medicine, a lot of consultants, senior doctors, do work in the private sector and they're under the NHS contract, are perfectly free to do it. What's your attitude in general? Because it seems to me from the outside that if the services are declining, and that is the perception, and more figures will show that, that people are desperate to get the treatment wherever they can.
Well, this is a very hard topic, and I just don't think there is, you know, the magic answer to that, to be really, really frank with you. And I love the NHS and I work and I see how it's falling apart. So that conversation has to be had. That's first thing. Secondly, I think the politicization of the NHS has happened for far too long. There are health secretaries who are coming in every 6 months to a year. They have no experience and all they want is really to generate some headlines to win the next election. That is a problem, and that's the same with migration. They isolate the refugees, isolate the asylum seekers to get onto Daily Mail, and somebody else tries to counteract that to get on The Guardian. That is where we're really losing track of the people who are suffering, who are the patients, who are the general population. So that's a very important point that Stephanie has mentioned as well. We need stability. We need for the parties to be talking about each other, that this is the NHS for everyone. Can we sit around the table? So first of all, that's a really important point. And to have that strategy, 5 to 10 year strategy for that, there's something that I do as the Times Health Commissioner. We've been looking into it for the past 1 year, and continue to do so. When it comes to privatization, it's very controversial, very hot topic, and immediately I don't like the sound of it because, you know, I love the NHS. But when, from the inside, but I can tell you how things are not working and it's impacting the patients. Then I say, okay, is there somebody else who can do this better than this big organization that we ask them to do every single thing? And that's where my innovation and my work in innovation comes in, is that, okay, if you have got this big organization that is doing amazingly well in treating patients who desperately need help in ambulances, in acute services, and we can safely take them to discharge them to community services so they can go back to their loved ones with the package of care that's available, for me, that's magical, if we can really solve that. But in between, if there is room for other providers who are doing better IT, who's, for example, doing better imaging in one area, who's doing something better, I do think that room should be available for them to come in, but not to take over, but to be part of the system, but allowed to efficiently and comprehensively provide that care. And then it should still be under the umbrella of the NHS with everything else, because you just can't take a chunk of the NHS and give it to somebody else. And that I worry about. But I also worry about that it's so politicized that as soon as you talk about private, and everybody looks at you that no, but I am from within and I can see that when I can't do something and it takes me 2 hours or days, and I know that there are people who are very good with technology and they can solve it in an hour, why would I want to wait that long?
That's a very powerful argument in terms of being at the ground level. There's a question down at the back. Keep your hand up, please, so they can see it. And then there's two more at the back. Go ahead, please. And then, yeah.
Can I say this, please?
Could you hold a microphone? We gave you a mic, if you could.
No, I'm fine, actually. Can everyone hear me? I do have quite a booming voice.
Yeah.
what I want to say is there's a level of hypocrisy within the medical profession. Because it's true to say that although you work within the NHS, you are equally able to go and practice privately within it. So what I'm really arguing is that there is not a complete commitment to the NHS, because the medical profession can fund their income by private work as well.
Okay.
What I also want to say quickly, sorry, the other problem is because the NHS has been politicised, as you have quite rightly said, the salaries are a sawtooth. In other words, the government allowed remuneration to collapse to the point of almost failure and people go on strike, instead of allowing salaries to reflect the way in which people become better at their jobs in a very smooth curve upwards.
Okay, we'll take that point. Just to also point out, salaries across the piece since the financial crash across the UK still haven't got back to what they were in 2007. So it's not just doctors, nurses, and consultants are amongst the top 1% of top 1% of earners. So again, the point about doctors being deflected to other outside work, not wholly committed to the NHS. That was the original deal done in 1947-48, wasn't it, Stephanie?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think the NHS has always been a compromise in that sense, because the only way in which Anaya and Bevan could get it together was to compromise, you know, with GPs who didn't want to become paid by the state. They wanted to remain as independent contractors.
So they are private contractors,
yeah,
for GPs.
Exactly. They contract into the service. Consultants wanted to retain the right to do some private practice. Although I have to say, you know, that is actually much less, I think, than it was in earlier generations.
Really?
But yeah, I think, you know, a lot of the sort of generations coming through, a lot of them just don't do any, whereas the older generations, they would tend to do a bit alongside an NHS practice. But I think, you know, that has been part and parcel of the NHS right the way through. You know, a lot of hospitals originally had one ward where you could have what they called an amenity bed, so you'd pay a bit extra for a bit more facilities, say television in the early days and things, but it didn't change the actual care you received from that point of view.
Okay. Can we check? People, hopefully we'll take a mic this time as well. You did have a booming voice, but a mic is provided. Keep your hand up behind you, just there. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, I'd just like to make a couple of observations, if I may. The first one is that we talk about the NHS, but in reality we don't have an NHS. We have a service in England, we have a service in Scotland, a service in Wales and a service in Ireland, and they're all completely different through various reorganisations that have taken place. So I think that's something we ought to bear in mind, because primarily I think we're probably talking about the NHS in England.
Yes.
The others work considerably different, and as has always has been remarked, a lot of the things that work better in Scotland or in Ireland or in Wales don't flow into England and vice versa. And then the other two points that I'd just like to make, one of them I know you're going to come on to, is the influence of the Treasury, which I know you will probably come on to, because I think the Treasury is... like a shadow over the NHS, and is responsible for a lot of the funding problems. It's a Byzantine funding system that the NHS has, and I defy anybody to understand it properly. But it does cause serious problems when you watch how the money flows and what changes that makes.
And your final point?
The final point is that the structure of the NHS, particularly in England, works against the NHS. We have this strange primary secondary care split, which causes immense problems for both sectors, and then we have the trusts, which are all independently working.
Well, as Stephanie's book will tell you, each decade has seen some sort of reorganisation. Some of them have been more calamitous than others, but there's always been this desire for change. Just on funding, your point, only this week, Wes Streeting, Labour's shadow health secretary, more than likely to be the Secretary of State for Health within a year or so, it says, stop putting the NHS on a pedestal, and I'm quoting directly, saying, we are not going to continue pouring more money into a broken system. It's just not worth it. So Labour aren't going to turn up with a whole bucket of cash and say, that's how you solve the NHS problems. So funding is going to be an issue going forward. So Stephanie, the Treasury... a shadow over the NHS. The Treasury mines everybody's money, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, within 18 months of the NHS being established, the Treasury were horrified because the costs were far exceeding the anticipated costs. And the way in which it was founded was on the expectation that if you have a population with poor health, and that was one of the real motivations for creating the service, if you actually improve people's health, then you will reduce demand for health services, so the funding will sort itself out.
As you say in the book, health inequalities were at the core of the 1948 decision.
Yeah,
health
absolutely.
Inequalities have worsened and are much worse in the UK than in other European countries. So again, the NHS hasn't worked, has it?
Well, what's happened is if you look at the way in which the disease spread has changed, you know, when the NHS started, people died from TB, they had sort of heart attacks, heart disease wasn't really treated, but now we've got a lot better at treating things like that. Loads of new treatments, loads of new technologies. So, for example, to have a hip replacement now is commonplace. I mean, one of the stories in the book is Norman Sharp, who had the first one done on the NHS in November 1948. That was a new technique that the surgeon had learnt from the American surgeons. I mean, there is now so many more possibilities. So I think that's why the funding is such a tussle, because you can always do more, and medically, you always want to do more. You want to give the patient everything you can, but you still got that tussle of the funding. And that's why I keep coming back to, you know, the NHS is in a really difficult position, and we need to have this conversation about, you know, what do we want it to fund? What do we want to be treated for? You know, what do we think is reasonable in 2024, 25 to expect from it?
That's a big question, because the expectations are everything is available all the time, free at the point of delivery. Mm. But, I mean, you see it every day. There are advances in medicine, which you read about, but we can't afford that particular drug because it hasn't been approved by NICE, or there are other things we could do, but budget restrictions mean we can't.
No, I absolutely agree with the gentleman just raising that question. First of all, the NHS is different, and I think that the lack of that communication, the lack of sharing the good practices is a big problem. And I talked about it early on, that even amongst trusts, there are some who are doing it very, very well. Some other trusts are struggling in certain aspects. So if we were to share the good practices, how do we make efficiencies, how the leadership is working well or not working well, and I think that's a very important, valid point that we need to take. And the other point I also agree with is that I just don't think the NHS can do everything. So we really need to prioritise what it's designed for to do, and which is really to treating people who are ill, who really desperately need our support, regardless of their financial circumstances, and get them home as quickly as we can, and then broaden that out of what other services need to be done. So rather than approving every single thing and saying, okay, this is the next big shiny thing that we need to have it, we need to have that discussion about this. The system is broken. I agree with that. And I think it needs quite a lot of redesigning before money is being poured into it.
There was another person just... Okay, there's plenty of questions. The mic here, and then we'll try to get to you all. Go ahead, please. I see you as well in the front. Yeah, thanks.
Hi, so I just wanted to say I'm an NHS nurse. So I moved from accident and emergency to intensive care and then neonatal intensive care after the pandemic, purely because of my own mental health and the trauma of the pandemic. And I've done the NHS and I've been a nurse since I was possibly able to. So I did my A-levels in healthcare. I went to university at 18, qualified as a nurse and worked my way up to a sister. And I'm 27 now, but I have absolutely nothing to show for that. And it often seems like we vilify nurses and doctors. And when we say we go on strike, I don't have my own house or mortgage. I still rent. I had to move out of my hometown because I couldn't afford a house there that the rent was. And I have to supplement my wage every month with agency shifts as a nurse because there just genuinely is not enough money for the cost of living. And the Daily Mail and all the press and quite a lot of the political parties vilify us for picking up those shifts, but I give the same level of care for turning up to do an agency shift as I do my normal shift, and I still work full time. So on my days off, I pick those up, and I still give the same level of care. And if I'm not there on that extra shift, that ward or that unit in my where I work now doesn't have that nurse. If that shift is not picked up, the same level of care has to be given to those babies or the adults, but with one less nurse or one less doctor. And I think it's just about realising that it's not our fault for having to pick up those extra shifts and work those extra shifts. But the pressure is there. And if actually those shifts aren't picked up, more and more nurses are just going to leave the profession or just go off sick because the pressures are too high.
Thank you for explaining that so clearly and the impact of all the shifts and the training and the commitment you've given. But still finding you can't live on it. Okay, we'll take a question with the lady in front here and then we'll go down the line again. So if you could keep your hand up for a second so we can see you, and then we'll go down this side in fairness, yeah. Go ahead.
Hello, this is rather a pie in the sky question. But Nye Bevan set up the NHS to cure a sink of illness, thinking that would be it. And the heroic medicine that's achieved today means that the demands on the NHS are so very different. And I just wonder if you were in a position to change the overall management of the NHS and take it out of the hands of politicians, what sort of design would you come up with?
Ooh. That's a big canvas. You've already been frank enough to say the system is broken. We have to learn best practice. But and we've talked about the pressures of funding. So have you got a minute with a big blueprint to help to make things better?
So before I address this question, this very big question, which I won't be able to, but I'd like to just say to my nurse colleague there that I really applaud her for coming and saying about her the issues that she's dealt with. And this is something that I would like to extend to the rest of the NHS, that, you know, it's not just the work that they do, it's the emotional expression that when we're dealing with patients, we're not robots. Mm-hmm. We have to attend to a crying baby, to a patient who is in pain, to a loved one who is complaining and say, like, where the hell have you been? You know, you haven't answered to me. De-escalate that. So it goes on and on and on. And it's, I'm not complaining. It is our job. Mm-hmm. And we really take the reward of dealing with it. But by the end of the shift, it starts to take its toll.
And none of us can appreciate that unless we've been
absolutely. And it's something that I can immediately see where she's coming from. And I see that amongst my other colleagues. As every weekend shift, it takes me Monday to recover mentally because I'm processing the traumas I've dealt with, the emergencies. Have I done enough for this patient? Have I done enough for that? You know, I'm pretty senior at the moment, but I'm still questioning things. You know, was I good enough in those situations? So, and this is not something emotional strain to be discarded, to say, you know what, we pay you. You know, you have got the option of the private, which really doesn't exist for many. And it's only towards the end of your career that nowadays you can go to Harley Street. It really doesn't apply to most people. And you've dedicated 20 years to practice, to get to where you are and not really taking advantage of for the payment and everything else. And then suddenly you're in a cycle where you're blamed for things. So you can imagine how much it breaks people from within. So just coming back to your question about the design, I think the design, I fully agree with you. We can't take it away from the hands of politicians. I think we need politicians. They're not all bad people. And I think this is where I have to really make a point, is they really are people who are trying their best. Majority, there are many who, you know, will be trying to push for really, you know, election or some other political agendas. The problem is, it's the revolving doors of health secretaries, politicians who don't understand what's going on. They haven't spent enough time. And within the NHS, we don't understand it, you know, having spent such a long time within it. And it does require talking to the parties across, to people who've got the experience, and speaking to the general public to see what they want. And I think that discourse, that conversation has to be opened up about the design, not to be done behind the doors. Let's try this, see what happens. Let's try that, what happens. So it has to be a national conversation.
And Stephanie, you mentioned about how the profile of illnesses has changed and what the NHS has to deal with today is very different from what the challenges were in the 50s. One issue which hasn't been addressed yet is obesity and the impact. They reckon that 1 in 6 or 1 in 7 admissions to hospital are related to obesity, which is a very complex issue to do with social inequality and poor wages and everything else. But that changes everything, doesn't it, in terms of the pressure it puts on? And they didn't have to deal with that in the 50s.
No, absolutely. There's that and a lot of other sort of lifestyle things. I'll come back to that in a minute.
Sure.
But I just want to go back. I just love your question, you know, what would the blueprint be? I think, speaking on behalf of the voices in the book and the wider collection, what people have fed back so strongly to us is that they want it taken out of the push and pull of the political time frames. So absolutely, you've got to have politicians involved, but you need something like a cross-party consensus, like the select committees run, so that you've got representatives from all the political parties. It's not simply a matter for the government of the day. And you also use lots of really strong democratic methods like citizens' juries, different consultations to have the public and all the stakeholder groups involved. And I think that way, that would be a way of going forwards to really get people engaged with what can they expect from the NHS, what should it look like. Going back to obesity, I think, it's a whole new set of problems. But one of the areas that the NHS has been good at times, but where funding has often been very tight, is public health. And so public health, like mental health services, have often been underfunded compared to other parts of the service. And I think, you know, the current sort of issues around obesity, smoking, addiction, you know, there are lots of examples there where we know that proper investment can really turn people's lives around and therefore take the strain off the health service.
But that does take a long time.
It does take a long time.
Right. this side, we promised we're going to come to. If you can put your hand up again. So we're starting here, and then we're going about three or four rows back. So keep your hand in the air so we can see you. Thank you. And there's one there. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess my question is, again, sort of regarding the whole shakeup that you get every 10 years. I mean, Cameron came along, broke up the PCTs, moved commissioning to the GPs. Now they're thinking of moving commissioning away from the GPs again. And all that really does is give money to consulting firms like Capita to go and make millions and millions of pounds rejigging their things and giving jobs eventually to ex-NHS people that brought them in. So wouldn't it be better to, as you said, move it out of the hands of the politicians into some cross-government capability and give it a certain percentage of GDP rather than arbitrarily allocating an amount each year or each decade or whatever they allocate?
I mean, the argument would be politicians are elected on manifestos. They set out their plans for the NHS, for schools, for defence. And if they win the election, they get the go-ahead to say, well, commit to your manifesto then. I don't know if you can exclude politicians from this because they are they're the only elected people in this. We don't elect the consultant who's going to do our operation.
No, I agree. I think the politicians can't be excluded. But when it comes to the management, the design, and that's where clinicians, that's where people who are within the NHS, I would strongly suggest that they're involved. Mm. And right from at the top level, so where the politician, they can oversee, let's say, or be involved with the budgeting, with the money aspect, the correlation to the other aspects within the country. But that decisions that are made, that's where the select committee is, that's where the public voices, when they are involved as well, what do they want and say, okay, this is the reality that we're dealing with. In my view, I think that would be the best way to cover it.
And the lady here has been very patient, thank you.
My question has been partially answered, but I'll still make the point. Dr. Wahid said earlier that the objective of the NHS is to, and I'm sorry if I'm putting words in your mouth, is to make ill people better and send them back out into the community. Surely it's a national health service, not a national illness service. And I think the comment about public health is what we should be aiming for. It's prevention, not cure, isn't it? You know, we've just talked. You know, you've just talked about all these 21st century diseases, which have got so much research around them, where we know, or we've got strong evidence to show where we should be going.
I think this is very, very important. If I may, jump into that as well. Absolutely, I think when I mentioned that the way the acute services are dealing with now, that's I was referring to that. That our urgent and acute services need to be able to have quicker turnaround, so we can deal with other people who have got illnesses and they are waiting in houses and ambulances. They don't have to wait, and as a result of that, suffer. But if you look at it broadly, it's prevention and the community. It's the two aspects. So you've got the acute services, the prevention. Really, we have to put a lot of effort into that. And that, in particular, applies to cardiovascular disease, obesity, you can link to that as well, high blood pressure. That definitely, there are ways we can reduce the prevalence. And then very importantly is the mental health. And it's very, very sad that every shift that I am in accident and emergency, that I see almost the same person coming in every 2 months because they really are not dealt with in the community properly. They're coming with a crisis, whether it's to do with alcohol, it's to do with drugs, it's to do with self-harm. And it's very, very heartbreaking that we are in the same cycle again and again and again, simply because we don't have the preventative mechanisms in place. We don't have, in particular when it comes to the mental health, which I'm so passionate about as well, that it's absolutely at the back of the queue within this, the conversations. And people who are suffering from complex mental health issues, they either have to wait a year or two just to be assessed. And when they're assessed, really, we don't have the comprehensive resources available, and it's very much varies across the country as well.
And everything is being backed up, accumulating, and those people aren't being treated. They're adding to the crisis in terms of the large number, 2.6 million people who are registered as not being able to work because they're suffering from ill health, which is a lot of people, and not getting the treatment they deserve. So there's another question back here. Yeah, did somebody have their hand up? Yeah, go ahead.
My point was about staff retention in the NHS, and you touched on funding and how perhaps there isn't going to be more funding, but I think that I've worked in the NHS as a GP for 30 years, and when I do sort of out-of-hours shift or working in an urgent treatment centre, the conditions are actually quite grim. And by that I mean that you have queues of patients to see, but if you wanted something like a cup of tea, then you have you know, milk that's gone off, so you have to have a black tea or coffee in a broken cup. And it just feels sort of a bit miserable and a bit grim, really. The pay has been static for many, many years. And I think that medical students now come out of medical school with £100,000 worth of debt. When they're in their foundation years, I think they've worked out that they earn, I think, about £14 an hour. You know, they're not going to stay in this system. And I think that's the key thing that we need to fix, like the nurse, that our nurse colleague was mentioning. Yeah. And there's so many job opportunities for them in Canada, Australia, and it's sort of really, why are people going to stay? And I think it's been rather lovely hearing these stories about the NHS and the book, because it is great. But, you know, I just think that...
Well, you've done 30 years, so, you know, you're a testament to how great it was, perhaps. But this was the point, in the early days, the value given to staff, not only in terms of pay and conditions, but there was that sense of respect. And now you're feeling when you're doing, I mean, this horrible little place, you know, no fresh milk, even the basics. And that's kind of a reflection of where the service seems to be stalled at.
Yeah, I think, I think staff retention is probably the biggest question for the NHS, sort of for the immediate future, because it's those local conditions that you're having to work in that will eventually get you to a point where you'll just say, well, actually, I don't have to do this anymore. I really can't bear it. And what a loss that is to the service. And it's the same in different levels. You know, nurses in big hospitals, they struggle to find a parking space. They have to pay for parking. You know, junior medical staff who work overnight, there is no hot food in the hospital. There's a machine and a microwave, and the machine's not filled over the weekend. So it's like, if we're not looking after our staff, how can we ask those staff to look after our patients? And I mean, I think we've heard just today, you know, you and the nurse and Waheed here, we know the quality of people that we have in the NHS, the compassion, the drive, the real dedication to wanting to do a good job. But the service has to provide those absolute minimums, you know, environments for people to be able to do that. And I do, you know, and that's the sort of issue that they're not impossible to solve. It's not like we need 40 more doctors. Where do we find them? You know, you can actually establish, you know, fresh milk in the fridge, you know, hot food here. This is here. You know, have people got a clean bed? Do they need to be sleeping overnight when they're on a shift? What do we do about car parking spaces? You know, have we got dark areas where nurses on their own after a late shift are having to walk on their own through dodgy areas? Yeah. Those very basic things about let's care for the staff, because caring for the staff then means that translates into caring for the patients.
Sure.
And it doesn't cost a lot.
Another question down at the back. Please, if I can, have you got no hand up there? Sorry, there is, yeah, we've got 15 minutes left. So if you keep your hand up here, it's the third, okay. Down at the back first, and I'll come to in the first, and then one or two others. Go ahead.
You mentioned some quite startling figures on the, I think it was 1 in 6 of people being treated in the hospitals are obese. Whilst it's vital that medical care is free at the point of use, does the NHS need to be challenging us as the consumers of healthcare on how we conduct our own healthcare rather than just wait until we have a problem and turn up at a hospital?
This is, yeah, if the government does this, it's accused of being the nanny state. If it doesn't, it goes back to your point. When you see patients, then you're dealing in an emergency situation. Right. So do you tell them, look, you've got to look after yourself a bit better, or you really should be not having 12 pints on a Saturday night?
I think this is an important point to address, but how to do it is not straightforward.
Yeah.
I think in my view, people deserve compassion. I think blaming is not the way. And I don't use that approach, and it doesn't work. really. Because people who have got one problem, whether it's the mental health, whether it's to do with their weight, they almost always have something else going on as well. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to extend that conversation to inequalities. So in particular, people coming from deprived populations or for demographics where they are a disadvantage, they really, again, they're going through takeaway shops, for example, or the family members are not really there. So there's a lot of social factors that come into play into that. There is mental health issues. They go hand in hand with physical health. And that is not explored very well, coming back to the prevention. So we can really look into it more of how to do design, actually, to make it more conducive for cycling, for example, to having better takeaway shops rather than having another chicken shop or another takeaway that's full of, you know, unhealthy food. So then you can extend that a little bit more. So when you're crossing there, you're hungry. Okay, you go and get some salad or something that's tasty, but at the same time, it's healthy. So I wouldn't necessarily just blame the patient for this. Yeah, but I think, as I say, it's very complex, but it goes hand in hand with prevention. It goes hand in hand with mental health. And it goes all the way to schools. So we have to really, because we're coming up with a younger population that is starting to put more weight on. And we really have to be very careful. And the mental health problems are starting to appear more. We're not really prepared for all that to come in years.
Yep. Yes, the gentleman there, and I'm conscious of the woman in the third row, will be the next question. So if you take it, and then we're going up towards the front.
Thank you. My question follows on from the earlier ones relating to prevention. And I wonder what your views are on the practical role of the NHS in preventing illness caused by work. Because I think Health and Safety Executive estimate about 13,000 people in England and Wales every year die from respiratory disease due to exposure to harmful agents in the workplace. What can the NHS do?
Would a lot of those respiratory diseases be related to heavy industries of the past? So is it a legacy issue or is it?
No. I think there's plenty of evidence that today's workplaces, small engineering factories, offices, other areas, 8,000 people a year are dying from occupational cancer caused by work.
Well, I mean, I think one of the really interesting things is that it was Bevan's experience of having grown up in the South Wales mining valleys and seeing the effect of those working conditions, both in terms of accidents on the workers, but also his father died from lung disease caused by inhaling the things down in the colliery. So I think that was one of the motivations for wanting to sort of treat people who couldn't get care and couldn't afford to pay for it. And I think you're right. I think there are a lot of areas like that which actually need renewed attention, because there is an assumption that we have much less industry now. We're mainly a sort of service economy. So the attention paid to occupational health is much more in terms of mental health and the stress of work in terms of emotional impact. Whereas, you know, you're saying, you know, we've still got these sort of industrial diseases.
When you were starting off working in London with Imperial College when you were studying, you were surprised at the number of cases, for example, TB, which you yourself had suffered for. You thought these were diseases of the past when it came to, you know, big cities like London, but your experience was, no, there's still some of them around, and some indication they may be even increasing again.
Yes, and I think that takes me to the point of inequalities, that although on one hand we can say that let's do this and apply it across the country, but then the demographic of the population really varies. So then that's one of the advantages of trust really adopting the methods, the strategies according to the needs of the local population. And hence it's so difficult to have an umbrella answer to how do you redesign. It's not an easy answer, because you go to some parts where I work, you know, I see quite a different cohort of people in comparison to if you were to go to London and you're practicing in London, even the accident and emergency, you will have quite different populations coming through the door, especially when it comes to the traumas of it as well. But you can extend that argument to many other parts.
Yeah. And it is a national service, so it's going to be different region by region. And if you could put up your hand again, this very patient audience member in the third row. Yeah, there you go. Thank you.
Hello. My question is about flexibility with recruitment and retention. My background is a sister in A&E and nurse practitioner. I'm now retired. And when COVID hit, I approached a local trust who didn't have anything in place at the time and offered my services. I didn't want to go back as qualified. I was happy to go with many years' experience as a healthcare assistant onto the COVID wards. And in the end, I couldn't do it because there was so much inflexibility. It had to be long shifts or no shifts. Yeah. And I know had I got back, I would have got drawn in. I would still be doing shorter shifts now. So is there a need for a little bit more flexibility to get us oldies back and keep these young nurses in?
Sounds like a shame that they weren't able to come to some arrangement with you. You come across this in terms of inflexibility. There are systems and you can't break that system.
Sure. Unfortunately, that's true. We do have quite a lot of inflexibility, and that is something, again, that affects staff retention, the staff morale, and that if it carries on, you can see the impact of that on families. You can see the impact of that on mental health. My colleague earlier on from there, the GP, has mentioned as well, it's the small things we look out for that in the workplace. Of course, you know, we talk about the salaries, that's a different discussion that we had early on. But when it comes to the workplace, it's about us being able to connect with each other, being able to have a moment to ask who we are. And that extends between colleagues and between management and the colleagues here as well, the front line. There's quite a lot of disconnect between that. People are in the back offices. They're very busy as well. It's not that they're not working, but the system design is such that there is not much compassionate communication going on. You know, this, we don't know what the CEO is up to or the other chief operating officer is up to, unless we see that in an email, and we don't know what the vision is. So coming back to, you know, why we come into the first place is to provide the best patient care possible. But then if it's diluted with workplaces, diluted with inflexibility, diluted with everything else, you're really left by the end of the day with very little to say, you know what, why would I have to put up with this any longer?
And as we've got the last 5 or 6 minutes, I started with that big disappointing statistic about going from 7th in the world for life expectancy down to 29th. This government and Labour have agreed in principle that there's going to be 1 million extra people employed over the next 10 years in the NHS. Ambitious, where are they going to find, train all of these people? But that will mean by the mid-2030s, 49% of all public sector workers will be in the NHS, and we'll be spending roughly 40% of every single percentage of economic activity on the NHS. So we basically will have an NHS and no money for schools, hospitals, potholes, transport, social care. Is that what we want? Is that affordable, basically? I mean, that this is, we're talking about priorities. You know, in fairness to the Conservatives, levels of spending on the NHS are at record highs. Doesn't feel like it, but they are at record highs. And they've projected they're going to spend even more in the next 10 years, getting up to 40% of all government spending will be just on the NHS. I don't see how a country can work like that. Stephanie, I mean, it started at about 5%, and then they were worried back then.
I think this is why we need those public conversations. And that's what was happening in the 1940s. There were lots of conversations about, can we afford this? You know, it's going to break the country. But actually, it was that push to try and improve the quality of life and health outcomes for everyone that was behind that. And I do feel we're now at a moment now when we need to look ahead to the next 75 years and come together and say, OK, we have to make choices. What are those choices? What society do we want to be? I mean, my view from all the people we've interviewed is that, you know, healthcare, which is free at the point of access to anyone who needs it, has to still be there. Mm. and the payment happens. Obviously, we all pay for healthcare, but it's not at that immediate point which could prejudice people's ability to access care. But what that care looks like, how much of health conditions it should cover, you know, what our role is in terms of, you know, doing our own contribution in terms of lifestyle, that's a matter for us all.
Mahid, what do you make of that? The amount of funding that is required, having taken the fact that Labour said, we're not chucking loads of money at this because it's a broken system, that's wasteful, we're going to have to reform. They haven't spelled out what the reform is, but there's no open checkbook anymore.
Well, I think coming back to what we all, I hope, agreed on is that it has to be a national conversation between the politicians. I really would love to see more public voices around that discussion table. Patient voices, public voices, professional voices, they can actually see the situation from a different angle, as well as clinicians being really allowed to make decisions as well, rather than just be there on the front line, orders being given by politicians, and we have to execute them, and we get frustrated with seeing the system as well. So I just don't think there is that magic answer to that question, whether, you know, that spending more will help or not. And if we really look into it from a perspective of everybody being a voice to that, like Stephanie's book, and the migrants, including the people who really dedicate their lives, the colleagues coming from various countries, standing shoulder to shoulder to really dedicate and to help and to provide the best patient care.
Can I just say thank you for being such a wonderfully engaged audience. We've got a sense of the complexities and the many issues involved. I'm going to remind you that Stephanie's Our Stories, and there are great stories in there. Wahid's incredible personal and professional story. And don't forget Dr. Julia Grace Patterson, who goes into the analysis as to why we need a campaign, effectively. I'm going to hand over those two books for you both to sign for me.
Okay.
And again, to say thanks very much. I didn't want to be too gloomy with some of the statistics, but unfortunately, the more you see these figures, there are huge challenges. And it's something which politicians have to deal with, but it's people in front line, like the doctors and the nurses and everybody else working in the NHS, and us as patients have to face up to the reality of as well. So thank you very much for your time, and don't forget the book. So please say thank you very much to Stephanie Wahid.
Thank you for listening to HIF Player. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. For more information about our arts charity and upcoming events, please visit harrogateinternationalfestivals.com.